Hello, this is the Somewhere on Earth podcast, and it is Tuesday, the 16th of April, 2024. Congratulations, we're nearly, I don't know, what, a quarter of the way? Third of the way through the year, assuming that you're on the Gregorian calendar and all that kind of stuff. What else do I need to tell you? Oh, I know what, we're in London. And we're in London with Peter Guest again. Hello again, Peter. How are you?
Very good. On the Gregorian calendar.
That's the calendar to be on. Well, for me anyway. Other calendars are available. And I'll tell you what then, right? We've had a bit of listener interaction from our good friend Neil on Facebook, who says that I know Bill Thompson. It's not that he knows Bill Thompson. He does know Bill Thompson. He says, I know Bill Thompson is a big fan of the Fediverse. Bill Thompson, by the way, being a well-known technology expert and a person who has been on this podcast as well, so many of you will know him. Anyway, let's just get to Neil's message. Sorry, I'll stop waffling. Neil says, I know Bill Thompson's a big fan of the Fediverse. So if you are too, you may like to experiment with subscribing to Somewhere on Earth in Mastodon. The name there is, 666-1055@ap.podcastindex.org. I won't repeat it, just jog back on your podcatcher if you're on Mastodon and you want to find us. And what this is, it's a bot on Mastodon that will tell everybody about new episodes as they come out. Neil, thank you for getting us on Mastodon. That saved me a job. I was about to get around to doing it. I'm just about on Mastodon myself. And might I see you there, Peter? Do you lurk? Are you or not? I know you're busy. I'm not. I won't judge you whether you are or you're not, but just wondering.
So first of all, I like that we have kind of the Mastodon bot number of the beast there, starting six.
Yes, I know. It's a good number.
But, I mean, I'm going to confess, I don't really understand the Fediverse. I have a vague sense of how it works, but I just haven't set aside that cognitive processing capacity to figure out why I should invest in it.
So there you go. Thanks very much, folks. And let's carry on. And coming up today, a take on artificial intelligence in this episode that you almost definitely haven't heard about until now. Yes, you've heard terms like disruptive and game changer, but how about, well, godlike? Well, we will find out a little bit more about where these theological connections come from. That's in part two of this here podcast. But in the first little bit, we're going to hear how a rapidly growing cryptocurrency is opening up a new front in Israel's fight against the funding of Iran-backed militant groups. Our reporter has been speaking to a former member of the US Treasury's Cyber Investigations Unit. So why does Bitcoin appear to be out and the rival crypto in if you just happen to be trying to transfer funds between prescribed terrorism networks? It's all right here on the Somewhere on Earth podcast. All right then, so let's talk about the fast-growing crypto network called Tron. It's quicker and cheaper than Bitcoin and has now overtaken that crypto for transactions by the likes of Iran-backed militant groups from Hamas to Hezbollah. As for the intelligence agencies and investigating organisations, there's less knowledge when it comes to tracking such transactions on Tron. So does this paint a rather worrying picture then? Shiroma Silva has been investigating.
We're all too familiar nowadays with terrorist attacks, but a key factor for counter-terror organizations is understanding the money supply. Well, one way that illicit money gets transferred is via cryptocurrencies. Now, the percentage of funding that criminal organizations get through crypto is said to be dwarfed by money obtained via more conventional means, but it's nevertheless a changing space that presents the authorities with challenges. Here's Louise Malloy from an organization called Tech Against Terrorism that analyzes and disrupts terrorist activity online using AI and open source intelligence, explaining why cryptocurrency can be so cool for bad actors.
So this decentralized structure is very good to bypass the verification role of traditional central authorities, as well as geographical constraints. So it allows for a very quick and irreversible transactions that can exploit regulatory gaps between jurisdictions. This transaction becomes really much harder to trace.
So the decentralized blockchain that crypto operates on has, on the whole, been less monitored than traditional means. Now let's turn to another expert, Rich Reinhardt, who works from Merkle Science, an organization that monitors criminal activity on the blockchain and finds ways to stop it.
So traditionally with money laundering, right, you use banks. Banks don't really change how you can get to your money. You either got to have a bank account, wire transfer, check, and you deposit either cash, wire transfer, or check. With crypto, it adds in the anonymity initially. Obviously, we can trace a lot of stuff now, but there's still anonymity involved, and it's more complex than traditional bank money laundering.
Rich, it turns out, oversaw crypto-related crimes at the Cyber Investigations Unit in the American Treasury.
I was an undercover agent who had to go meet people exchanging Bitcoin for cash, purporting myself to be a narcotics trafficker or some other illicit actor, where I would go meet people and ask for Bitcoin for cash or sell my Bitcoin for cash. I did that for 7 years.
The Bitcoin he spoke about here was a talk of the town a few years ago, but now the authorities have been better able to penetrate the blockchain on which it sits.
Yes, we've caught up with Bitcoin. If you were just using traditional Bitcoin and converting it and cashing it out somewhere, it most likely is going to be found.
The military arm of Hamas, called the Al-Qassam Brigade, has also caught up.
In 2023, Al-Qassam Brigades declared that it will stop receiving donations in Bitcoin in order to ensure the safety of its donors in the light of the general intensification of persecutions and freezing of assets.
And the new kid on the block seems to be a certain anonymous currency called privacy coins.
They have been developed with the sole purpose of conducting anonymous and untraceable transactions by hiding the source and destination of each transaction, as well as the amount of transactions, although they tend to require a higher level of technical capabilities than Bitcoin.
According to Tech Against Terrorism, this change is there for all to see on a popular platform that translates official Islamic State content into various regional languages.
This website is accessible on the surface web and on the dark web. And interestingly, this platform changed cryptocurrency donations request from Bitcoin to Monero a few years ago, stating that Monero offers better security and privacy features than Bitcoin.
The same has been shown in their monitoring of pro-Al-Qaeda groups. But another rise that's been noted is a surge, this time in a network called Tron, on which a light has been shone much more brightly since October the 7th.
Recent reporting has notably suggested that Tron has become the blockchain of choice for transactions carried out by Iranian-backed entities that are a part of the axis of resistance against Israel, namely Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Hezbollah. Many of those Tron crypto wallets linked to these organizations have recently been seized by Israeli authorities.
Recent research shown to us by Merkle Science indicates that from the beginning of 2020 to October 2023, more than 95% of crypto funding for both Hamas and Hezbollah was on Tron, although the purposes of those funds can't definitively be stated.
Tron's a little bit more difficult to trace. It's on a separate network from Ethereum, Bitcoin. It's on its own network. The transactions are a lot faster, cheaper than Bitcoin, so the funds move a lot quicker. There's a lot of different chain hopping features within Tron that makes money laundering a lot easier. Chain hopping means you can go from one currency to another currency's chain very quickly.
That ability to swap currencies within it can help muddy the waters.
It becomes very complicated when you start hopping on different chains. So if you take your Bitcoin, then you change it to Tether, and then you change that Tether to Solana. There's a lot of different things that can happen to make the tracing that much more difficult.
And a recent report by the UN cites an increased use by criminals of the cryptocurrency Tether USDT that's pegged to the dollar on the Tron network. Tech Against Terrorism has also noticed such activity.
We have found evidence of Gaza-based charities that are likely affiliated with Hamas, which have been calling for donations to support the people in Gaza in TRC-20, so Tether USDT issued on the Tron network.
Although Rich would caution against exact figures for the use of Tron for the Gaza war, the general shift to the network is nevertheless worrying. The crypto players cited in this piece were approached. In response, USDT Tether said,
Tether proactively collaborates with global law enforcement agencies to identify and prevent illicit use of USDT. Our commitment to the highest standards of compliance is evident in our efforts to eliminate various forms of criminal activity. Through close cooperation with law enforcement, Tether has successfully contributed to freezing addresses involving sanctions, violations, scams, and other illicit practices.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
They went on to explain that every transaction is recorded immutably on the blockchain, a public ledger, making illicit transactions easier to trace. While figures point to the majority of crypto of all denominations being used for legitimate purposes, it's keeping law enforcement on its toes.
Traditionally, if I was working a narcotics money laundering case or a black market peso money laundering case, after one or two of those cases, you kind of become the expert in the area and you can figure out what's going to happen. With crypto, it takes longer to identify the bad actors. And then by the time you become proficient in one area, all of a sudden everything's changed and there's a new way of moving the funds. So I don't think we'll ever win the game, but we can make an impact and deter future bad actors.
Richard Reinhart there, ending that report from Shiroma Silver. So Peter, guest here in the studio, listening to that, what did you make of what you've just heard?
One thing we will see a lot in technology is that criminals and associated organizations are incredibly entrepreneurial, right? So often lawful authorities are one step behind, several steps behind, and they're always adapting and reacting to this. So it didn't surprise me very much to hear the kind of basis of this. I mean, I reported a few years ago on how North Korea has been using crypto as a way to launder money and, you know, thieving money from crypto exchanges and laundering it in through various different illegal channels. So I think that didn't surprise me at all. I do think you also bring me on when there's crypto stories to sort of wind me up, because...
Is it working?
I mean, look, you and I have talked about crypto a lot on this podcast, and I think there is a very wide gulf between the sort of stated vision of crypto and its reality. And that kind of philosophy of decentralized, citizen-owned, socialized currency seems really reasonable, right? It's particularly if you've been through, many of us have been, you know, a couple of financial crises, you maybe don't trust your government with your financial data. But you also have to look at the main original use cases of crypto. You know, crypto is very hard to turn into fiat currency. It's always been a medium of exchange in slightly sketchy parts of the internet. And its early kind of use cases were in criminality. Mm. So isn't that surprising that, you know, here we are again?
Well, you might think, especially hearing there that, you know, some of these bad actors, as it were, they've been switching over to Tron really through market forces. So they say, here's a product, it's quicker, it's cheaper, it has more benefits, so we're going to go over there. So hold the front page, that's just economics. But hearing there about Bitcoin, how it is a bit slower, how it's not a trivial process to convert Bitcoin into cash. And I often do think, like, almost like, not what is the point of, but has the case for using Bitcoin been exaggerated when it's such, really, a comparatively illiquid asset compared, for instance, to a $50 note?
Yeah. It's an illiquid asset. It has a lot of risk attached to it. It's hard to liquidate into fiat currency. You know, a couple of years ago when I was reporting on the North Korean money laundering, you know, somebody who was an investigator, had been an investigator at the FBI, told me that if the kind of thieves, the North Korean hacking gangs, got 50% of the worth of their crypto back, they were happy with that, right? That was fine. So it's an inefficient way of actually turning illicit profits into cash. I think the use of stable coins is really interesting. Something that, again, to the kind of market forces behind this, your value of your Bitcoin can go down quite dramatically as well. Whereas with a stablecoin, you're effectively transacting in dollar amounts, right? It's a very useful tool for a money launderer.
Yeah, so just expand on that, because my money laundering knowledge is a little bit naive, to say the least, then. Well, just being pegged to the dollar. So at least, you know, if you're trying to launder some money and the recipient at the end of probably quite a long chain of money laundering steps, possibly through a whole number of other currencies, but if you all know that you've got this dollar peg, then everyone knows what the value is.
So, precisely, yeah. And also, you don't have to worry about the value of it changing.
Yeah, right? Sure.
The wild swings in crypto mean that, you know, you're effectively taking on kind of currency risk as you move your money around and as you kind of launder it into systems. I mean, look, I think one thing I'm going to say, and this is kind of utterly anathema to the crypto world, which is that there are a lot of really quite good reasons why we have financial regulation. Right? In another life, I reported on the financial sector, and the kind of anti-money laundering, know your customer, anti-terrorist financing laws, they accumulated over decades and decades of slow and boring practice and agreements and so on. Like, these are the things which are anathema in the crypto world. Like, the whole idea of crypto is we don't need regulation, we don't need supervision. It's like, well, sometimes actually you probably do.
Yeah. And I know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who has lost their Bitcoin passwords. Apparently they've got about 16K in UK currency. They're desperately trying to search through their files to work out their password. And it's not as if there's a bank branch you can go into and show your ID and say, can you just unlock my account, please?
No, and I do think kind of people searching for hard drives with lost crypto is all part of the mythology of the industry. Living the dream. I think, look, you know my feelings on crypto. I think there are some very, very good use cases. And I think going back to, we talked about the Fediverse at the very top of the show, right? And I think there are really good use cases for federated, communalized, socialized forms of technology and stores of value and stores of what kind of verification and so on. But yeah. How do I put this for that?
You're genuinely wound up, actually. I'm quite enjoying this.
Look, wound up isn't the way forward. I think that you have to think really carefully about the players in the industry, and you know, naming names and so on. We've named some coins in that. I think it is hard to separate the crypto industry as it is now from some of its leading lights. And if you think about where we were a year and a half, 2 years ago with two of the biggest crypto exchanges in the world, you can Google them. One of the founders is in jail. The other one has pleaded guilty to money laundering in the United States. It feels difficult to untangle the kind of criminality from the industry. And you have to wonder, is it actually part of the source code or is it a bug?
Yeah. Wow, Peter, let's leave it hanging on that question and get some listener interaction. Come on, dear listener, that's going to fire you up either way. Are you with Peter or are you a happy Bitcoin or Tron holder saying this is genuinely world-changing and, whatever. So you probably know our socials by now. We're on the Facebook, we're on the Twitter, we are now on the Mastodon and various others. So just search for SOEP, Somewhere on Earth podcast, and you'll find us on the social media. And please, just let us know what you think and let's get a conversation going on this. Making it sound a bit like a phone in there, aren't I? Peter, thank you. It's pre-record Gareth here, interrupting the live Gareth with an important message. Yeah, they're just playing this in to give me a rest. Aren't they clever? And the message is, please subscribe to the extended version of this podcast, won't you? It's where the guests often relax. I get to wing it a bit and we find out more about people's work and their lives. It's $10 a month. Most podcatchers open up the subscription content if you just click on the padlock or something. And or you can go to somewhereonearth.co, press the big button on the left-hand side to subscribe or the big button on the right to donate. You can opt out at any time, and because we know it's so easy to cancel, we really do try to make it good. No filler, just a bit of extra bonus content to make your and our day. Well, now, picture the scene. It's 1968, computers are the size of houses, and society's only really just getting used to electronics made of solid-state components as opposed to energy-hungry, heat-producing, fragile, unreliable solid-state valves. You're at a big computer conference. Remember, this is 1968. You're in San Francisco. And engineer Douglas Engelbart stands up and in 90 minutes demonstrates everything from word processing to video conferencing. It's a demo that goes down in history as the mother of all demos. People spoke of Engelbart as dealing lightning with both hands. It's a story most recently told in Kester Bruin's new book, Godlike, A 500-Year History of Artificial Intelligence. Kester is an author and speaker. He's also head of communications at the Institute for the Future of Work. And Engelbart's Zeus-like marvels at that 1968 meeting are just part of a story of humans, technologies, beliefs, hopes and horrors stretching back half a millennium. Appropriately then, the book's cover is a riff on Michelangelo's Creation of Adam. Godlike isn't a call for us to venerate AI with some kind of devotional reverence. It's a warning in some ways, but it's certainly not anti-technology. What it is, says Kester Bruin, is a suggestion that theology might be a rather handy framework in which to at least have conversations about one of the most powerful things human beings have thus invented.
I guess I've been concerned that actually, if we lose that ability to talk theologically about systems and ideas that are much greater than any one of us or any one community, then we lose something quite important. And for AI as a system, which could be described in that kind of godlike terms, as in, you know, there's no one person in control of it. There's no kind of central node that you could say, oh, it could be turned on or off or something. But it impacts us greatly in kind of odd ways, globally, in individual communities, in kind of almost religious language that's talked about its powers or its potential. And I think actually that there's some kind of theological language is kind of really useful for us to be able to use as we talk together about how we interact with these very big systems. What's the psychotherapist and kind of philosopher Jacques Lacan would have called the big other. So you might call communism a big other system in that, you know, it's this kind of grand ideology whereby someone might say, look, hey, you know, I don't mind that you've criticized the leader. It's not like I want to have to send you to the kind of labor camp, but the system says that I should. So our interactions with these systems can kind of change the way that we act out our beliefs and ideologies. And I think AI specifically, but technology in general, can be seen as one of these kind of grand systems that we need to be thoughtful about and reflective, just in the way that we're kind of thoughtful about our other beliefs and interactions.
Yeah, and you're at pains not to be either pro or anti AI. But, you know, speaking of the big other, there's this brilliant passage on page 122 for people who want to go and look it up in your book, where you really are in full flow. And this kind of just this one paragraph or couple of sentences sums up a lot of what you're saying in the book. So I'll pretentiously quote it back at you and then you can tell me a bit about it. But it's just Kester in full flow here. Those who have taken billions in investment have created a new kind of big other, a voracious, data-hungry big brother that'll be sold back to us with the promise that it knows more than us, can take a wider view than us, understands in greater depth than us, and, if we let it take the reins, will make our work easier. And in doing so, in the face of a quasi-religious force that comes from making the same kind of promises, we risk re-abdicating our executive functions to a new, higher authority. There it is, all in those sentences there.
Yeah, I suppose from my background in a kind of more Christian tradition, there's these verses in the scriptures, you know, that God knows even the numbers of hairs on your head, which if your listeners could see me, they would realize that there aren't many on my head at all. Not a particularly large language model problem that needs in terms of counting the hairs on my head. But in terms of the amount of data that we kind of interact with, just whether that's through banking, through driving, through walking about, through using our phones, we are offering enormous amounts about who we are to these models. And those models will make a great promise back to us. That data will be used to really help us in a kind of benevolent way. But I think that promise is going to need delivering on in terms of the vast amounts of capital that's been invested into these things, and they're going to want returns on that. And that means that it's not some kind of simple choice of, oh, you know, maybe we'll use AI, maybe we won't. There's going to be an enormous pressure to do that. And it's that almost kind of religious pressure of like, look, this is what we're doing. This is how we function now as a society. And there's going to be a lot of influence towards companies, towards everything, to be able to use these systems. The promise being, it's all for your benefit. It's going to save you. It's going to make things better. But actually not so much talking about the cost to us. If you look at the kind of power of the church through history, to take again that Christian tradition, that promise has been very complicated, because actually it's been often about controlling people, but doing that by saying, oh, you know, we'll offer you something great, we'll offer you salvation. So there's a complex interplay between a large structure which has a very powerful leadership offering something amazing to people on the ground, and the people on the ground saying, oh, you know, yes, this is absolutely what we want. But are they being told what to desire, or are they actually being offered what they truly do desire? And it's this process of the kind of empire power structures that these tech companies are taking on. And you look at the, you know, something like the presentations that Steve Jobs used to give. I mean, they were kind of almost like kind of evangelistic revival meetings. I mean, the fervor that people had, and the, you know, the complete commitment of the zealots about the iPhone and the new thing and the new thing. It's a really kind of extraordinary thing. If you look at it kind of anthropologically, it looks like a religious meeting.
Yeah, but, and of course you cite Doug Engelbart, who famously invented the mouse, but much more. But his demos that influenced those Steve Jobs demos, but the mother of all demos, 1968, you know, was described as being Zeus-like, wasn't it? Dealing lightning with both hands.
Yeah. So this religious language coming back even then, and then, you know, and that religious language has kind of been around right from the birth of AI. In that people have seen it as this opportunity to really kind of augment ourselves in a very, very radical way.
Where does this leave us then, finally? And I suppose what I'm prompting you into is a discussion that came out in your book launch in a local bookshop around here. Yeah. And you made this really lovely point towards the end of the Q&A about, let's take the benefits of the technologies, absolutely. But at the same time, you know, remind ourselves about the joy of, you know, just getting hands-on, I don't know, with a block of wood. You can put it better than me, because they were your words, not mine. But how do you see this?
To be very clear, this is not a book that is anti-technology at all. And in fact, I make the point that you can't be anti-technology. You know, your clothes are a technology, glasses are a technology. There are some would say that language itself is a technology. And these are all wonderful, wonderful things. And they offer us enormous, enormous benefits. But what we have to do is to be reflective about our technology use rather than passive and simply take on everything that the great, powerful technology companies who are using, you know, leading edge neuroscience to kind of hook us in, to keep us on their sites and all the rest of it. We've got to be really reflective about it. And my plea is, particularly that in an age of AI, which is going to put enormous challenges around trust and authority, you know, can you trust what you're hearing? Can you trust what you're seeing? That actually the places where we will be best able to trust one another and to kind of come together and to reflect on that is in physical communities, where we're able to kind of meet together at that kind of medium scale and kind of develop relationships based upon that, that aren't necessarily mediated by the algorithm. And I think it's still incredibly important for people to do that. The promise of technology has been to connect us with one another, and it does that in that, you know, we're able to get onto Zoom for people from all over the world. But there's a kind of atomizing effect of that too, in that it kind of ends up splitting us up in funny ways. So my plea is that in order to better reflect on technology and what we really want to do with it in terms of getting the best from it for the most people, we need to kind of return to those mid-level structures that have been so eroded. Whether that might be membership of a church or a trades union or a bowling team or a worker council or something, where you're meeting in person in a kind of trust-like space to do things, you know, in that physical space that really kind of enhance our human flourishing.
That's Kester Bruin talking to me a bit earlier. Peter Guest, where do we even start to unpack that? And this whole idea that, you know, AI, it's kind of a system that's greater than us all, yet it is of us, and it impacts us all. Kester, making comparisons almost there with huge systems like communism, you know? It's, anyway, interesting chat.
So I think on one level, I have a slight scepticism around the capabilities that people ascribe to AI. I think quite often we're talking about things. I mean, Elon Musk was in the news relatively recently saying that within a year we'll have artificial intelligence that surpasses human. That feels very unlikely.
This idea that we're approaching the singularity, as it's been called.
Exactly, given that we don't really at this point fully understand, even the people who build the models often don't fully understand how they work. And I think there's a risk of overplaying the hype and that, you know, the magic of Arthur C. Clarke, you know, suitably advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. It very rapidly becomes quite mundane. I'm also really nervous about the framing, to be honest with you, because I think there is a lot of mythology around big tech and around AI specifically. And we've talked about this in previous episodes, about the kind of apocalyptic imagery and language around AI. You know, it's going to end the world, it's going to save the world. And I think that creates quite a convenient distance for people in the industry from those of us downstream who end up using or being used by the technology. Mm. And I kind of, they like to say things like they've opened the taps to this divine thing by creating AI and they don't know how it works. Well, it's not an abstract thing. It's still the sum of decisions made by people. People program the algorithms, they set the rules, they set the limits, they decide the data. And if they can't control the results, that's still the consequence of the decisions that they make, right?
Well, it's applied statistics, as the aforementioned Bill Thompson calls
precisely.
It, and others have done, yeah. Okay. And I suspect if Kester was here, he'd probably say, look, I'm not trying to make some case that AI, he's certainly not saying it's perfect. And maybe even not necessarily that it is completely ruling our lives. It might be more just how ubiquitous it's and how rapidly ubiquitous it's become, you know, just in terms of, you know, HR decisions around people's CVs. And I know in other conversations, Kester's talked about, you know, the problem of bias in AI, you know, the idea that, you know, you can barely type an email these days without some kind of AI predicting what you're trying to write. It's almost like wherever you look, it's kind of there. Sometimes the conversations about AI that are purely about the algorithm, maybe purely about the commercial side and so on, they're all very well and they're important conversations. But if we just take that kind of longer view and the historical view going back 500 years and other attempts at building technologies that augment human capabilities, that it might get us somewhere in the conversation around AI. But again, I understand and I resonate with your reservations about that maybe kind of too godlike framing, for want of a better word, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And AI is, someone put it to me recently, it's an omni-use technology, right? It's going to touch the way that we, well, potentially, saying we're still in the very early days, right?
Yeah.
And the capabilities are still not clear, right? It will touch so many things of about what we do. In the same way, we've lived through the internet changing through a variety of different iterations. It's quite possible this will be a whole new one. My personal view is that we have to be a bit careful about religious framing because, first of all, it creates a sense of a lack of control, right? We don't have control over it. We've talked in recent episodes about the infrastructure of the internet. Well, you do have control over the infrastructure of AI. You know, it's literally pipes and data centers and cables, right?
Or do we, though? I mean, how much control do I have, for instance, over, you know, all the sum total of all the data that I've submitted to the internet in various forms over the years that can be ingested by AI models and then maybe used against me or for me without me noticing or even being able to know whether that's the case?
I think gradually you can run to my point of view, guys. I think.
And I'm not. By the way, I'm not making an argument that we should hype it and say this amazing thing. But
no, I think that's fair though. I think again that goes to the point of like if we are on the cusp of a major change to the way that societies and economies interact through this technology, mediated through this technology. Now's the moment to not look at it and go, oh well, that's a divine being, we can't control it. Now's the moment to go, hang on, who's the guy in the robe who tells me he's the priest, right?
Yeah, sure. And so therefore, would your argument be we should avoid too much a kind of a fatalistic argument that it's there in the same way that religion is there, that to just say AI is there, it's ubiquitous, it's going to happen, it is happening, maybe possibly a bit on the fatalistic side, and that we should understand that we all have agency, or at least should do our best to exert our agency when we can, in terms of the data we submit, the decisions we make about the products we buy, maybe even political decisions that could all have some kind of bearing on the way that technologies continue to be shaped and affect or don't affect our lives.
Yeah, I think you've put it pretty well.
Something like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think maintaining agency and maintaining a sort of sense of reality as well. I think we have to be really cautious about allowing the hype to overtake the reality. I think AI is going to be a massive and amazing thing, right? We will see incredible use cases. We will see terrible use cases. A lot of the use cases that will be part of our lives will feel quite mundane and will be quite mundane. I think ascribing to it too much allows people to get away with quite a lot.
Right. Okay. Brilliantly put. Thank you, Peter. That'll do. Well, it won't quite do. Should we carry on talking about this in the podcast extra?
Let's do that.
Who knows where that's going to go? All right. So that's coming up in the podcast extra. Do subscribe for just $10 a month to hear more where this came from. In the meantime, let's say a big thank you to Keziah and Callum have been doing the audio this week. The production manager is Liz. We're here at Lanson's Team Fana, all under the editorship of Anya. And I'm Gareth. You've heard there from Peter. And if you're not here for the podcast extra, see you next time. Bye-bye.